case you're just joining us, this is Aspire with Osha, Art, Nature, Humanity, and I'm your host, Osha Hayden. I'm here today with artist and art collector Jack Leisring. We're going to be talking in this part three about his incredible private art collection. I wanted to ask something about the art in your collection.
Ah, yes.
Let's talk about that. Because you started collecting the art when you were a kid.
Yeah, I was about 13.
Yeah.
My father and mother were divorced when I was very young, and I was raised by my father. My mother was a movie actress and model. She's very, very beautiful, but she left, wanted to go back to England where her relatives were, and wished to go into movies. So she left. That was a big thing in my life.
How old were you when she left?
18 months.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
So you hardly knew your mother.
No, but fortunately, I had this incredible grandmother and grandfather. So we moved in with Grandma and Grandpa. And my father. Father and I shared a bedroom for many, many years. When Grandma died, I got her room. And I don't know where it came from. I am very interested in interior design. And so I ended up designing a room for myself that was really quite something. I made the carpet or rug for the room out of carpet scraps that I sewed together. And this is an old house with panel doors. And I put leopard skin fabric in the insets in the doors. And the drapes were bright red. The wallpaper on the wall and ceiling was sort of a basket weave of chartreuse and gray. And so I had to have a painting that I wanted to put on the walls. My friends knew a painter, so I arranged to have him paint me two paintings in a kind of a Picasso-like fashion of Native American idols. And they were done in the same gray and almost chartreuse color. So I had my piano in there, and I had a Hollywood so-called bed. My cousin taught me how to sew, so I sewed all of the curtains and made the bedspreads myself. And so that was my first big foray into interior design. Came out pretty cool, actually.
Yeah, well, it's like, you know, you have your own space, finally.
Right.
You have your own space, and now you get to design it and create it and make it artistic and make it reflect who you are and who you're becoming to be. So at the same time, it is almost like an expression of your personality as you're developing. Next up in my conversation with Jack Leisring, we talk about the influence of artistic design on people and about how Mr. Leisring chose the 4,000 artworks in his collection.
Ayrton, you know, the artist I mentioned, and Yehudi Menuhin met and had a discussion on BBC Radio. In probably 1972, something like that. And they were talking about the influence of artistic design on people. And Menuhin mentioned the fact that if you don't feel comfortable in the space you're in, you are adversely affected by it. And to me, even though I was constrained in this building by the rectilinearity of its functional state, there are some circles in it, and there are lots of curved walls. And these curvings are extremely important to me. Ayrton brought up, he said, there isn't a straight bone in the human body. And what doesn't manifest us in our environment makes us uncomfortable. So we're stuck in these square boxes in which they're cheaper to build than something with odd angles. But I find myself transfixed by going into a space like the ones that were created by my friend, the architect Carson Bowler. And even here in town, if you go into a building done by Larry Simons, the interior feels like you're in a transcendent space. And these are the kinds of things that are essential to me. I have to have when I was in college, I roomed with a guy who was an engineer, so I papered his half of the room with blueprints, and my half had sheet music.
But yeah, you know, it's true. We don't have a lot of straight lines and squares and boxes like that in nature.
No, not in nature.
And I think that's why I'm with you in terms of liking the curved line and a space that has a more organic feel to it. Mm-hmm. Because there's sacred geometry. I went to once a big whole expo on sacred geometry, and they were talking about how these spaces, the geometry of our spaces, affect us.
That's true.
You know, do they elevate us or do they constrain us? Do they hem us in and sort of imprison us? Mm-hmm. Or do they, you know, lift us? So I think that that's a really important thing. I always want to live in a really organic, wild kind of treehouse, actually.
Mm-hmm. The treehouse would be fun.
Yeah. You want to talk a little bit about like the extent of your collection and some of the artists in it? You have Michael Ayrton and...
Yes, I started out, you know, I have a great interest in philosophy. And one of my favorite philosophers is... a fellow by the name of R.G. Collingwood, who was at Oxford, yeah, I would say in the 50s, 40s and 50s. His father was an artist and his brother was a sculptor. So he knew personally what art meant, apparently, at least in this family unit. His contention was that art was a semiotic. It's a, you know, like a semaphore. It's a message being sent by the artist who has an emotion. And the emotion is not possible to translate into words. So the artist translates it into the way she can do it. And that's with art, sculpture, might be music, it might be something that has a direct connection to that that emotion, whatever mm-hmm. that was felt. So I come along now, and I see something on a wall in a museum, and I'm suddenly struck by the fact that I just received something, and I feel it here in my chest, or I feel it somewhere in my body, that I am having almost the same emotion that that person had, that when I see a painting by X or Y, I get the feeling that they've sent me a message. So this is the method I have used to collect my work.
By the emotional impact that it has
always,
on you.
Only.
Mm-hmm.
Now, some people have recommended that I perhaps write a little essay, a little critique, a little something about each piece that I own. And that would be an enormous undertaking, because the book, if it were a book, it would have to be a page for the work and a page for the critique. So it's an 8,000-page book, which is very heavy. And so that doesn't really work.
And you're also trying to translate this image, this being, this thing in front of you that is an essence of emotion, you're trying to then break it down into words.
Yes.
Which...
it can't be done.
It's not going to...
can't be done.
Give you the same...
it can't be done. I remember T.S. Eliot saying a poem could be understood on two levels. One is the fact that the sound of it, just the phonemes, were affecting you. And the other is that you could understand why the poet was writing this, because he was a Catholic or he was a this or a that, and he was writing about his knowledge. I think that the same thing applies to art. I think that you might know that Picasso was playing around with cubism, but you might not know that. You might just like the work.
So getting back to talking about the labyrinth and where we are at this point in time, humanity really is at a point of crisis. We are looking at, I think if we were in a labyrinth, I think we would be looking at the possibility of a big dead end. So when you find yourself at a dead end in the labyrinth of life, how do you find your way? What sacred thread do you follow to find your center and find a way through?
Well, people use different means, I think. I'll tell you the one I use. My grandfather was a great reader. He would, I guess, do the same things that I realize I now do. And I just realized this moment that I read every night before I fall off to sleep. So he would do the same thing. And on his bookshelf, when I was 15, I saw this book written by someone by the name of Crawford, R.D. Crawford, written in 1937. And the title of the book was Think for Yourself. And it was one of these books that almost are in the guise of a so-called self-help book, in that there were blank pages in it where you could write your own ideas. Well, the theme of the book was to basically trust your own thoughts and don't listen to the garbage that comes in through your ears or through your cell phones or your TV or radio. So this has been my goal and the way I do it. I try to tell those people that I have influence over, like my sons, to think for themselves and accept their own intuitive understanding of how things work. Because unless you do that, you can become Pavlovianly influenced by all of these inputs that are, if you think back over the influence of, for example, this guy Bernays, he invented how to advertise. Mm. He was a nephew of Sigmund Freud, and he had a lot of psychological knowledge.
That's Bernays. Edward Bernays. You might want to look it up. Very interesting guy, and it will open your eyes.
So in the days when women were not allowed to smoke because that was a no-no in society, he organized a parade in New York City where the women walked down some major street all smoking cigarettes. Now, of course, now that we know that the tobacco companies were the cause of many deaths, we still can see how they worked. I have a collection on PDF form on my computer of Life magazine from 1940 through about 1960 or 70. And you can go through each one of the magazines and see on the back page an ad for Camels. And of course, the doctors were telling you that Camels were good for you. So we were part of the problem.
humanity does seem to often be part of the problem. That whole myth of the Minotaur and King Minos and Daedalus and all of that, you say that it is sort of a metaphor for the human condition, and that's because you have the greed, the lust, the deception, you know, all of the negative emotions that basically imprison us in so many ways. And then there are media outlets right now that use those negative emotions to try to imprison people, trap them in little mental box of their thinking, and then they take away the way out. They take away the exit, which would be, well, there is some actual source of truth out there. There is an actual verifiable facts that exist in the world. Well, they take that away so that you don't have an exit out. And so many people fall into these traps now because this is the only source of news. This is the only reality. And every other form of reality that you could judge it by has just now been erased.
Well, I've been thinking about this a great deal because I think I was born a skeptic. That's in my DNA. And I remember, much to the chagrin, I'm sure, of my professors, my hand would go up, and I usually sat in the back of the room, and said, "Sir or Madame, how do you know that?" So I think it is essential for each one of us to consider the possibility that some aspects of education may not be the most useful thing to have. It generally puts a fence around your knowledge, and often there is no gate to leave. You are so indoctrinated into the knowledge scheme that you have, that you've paid a lot of money and time to go through, that you never have an opportunity to ask whether this is correct or not, or whether this is true. Is there such a thing as truth? And that's worthy of asking too. I would recommend meditation as being the source or key to opening a gate of your own, somehow becoming more satisfied with your own thoughts, that thoughts are not coming from old professors or
the media.
I didn't want to aim at one place, but we are so binary these days. There's either a black or a white, and it's of course always the middle where we end up. I remember when I was in India years ago, there's this place called the Elephant Cave. And there's a piece of sculpture that shows a right and a wrong, and then this middle piece. And together, they form what is a kind of truth in that Hindu way of looking at things. And I have a friend, one of my college roommates, who was a polymer chemist most of his life. When he quit, he became a philosopher, and he's written two books on what he calls logic in reality. In reality is, to me, what we take binary things, yes, no, or right, wrong, and we bring them to a central point where there's a little bit of wrong and there's a little bit of right, but this is where we conclude our thoughts.
Mm-hmm.
So somehow, I think that's the way it works. It works among friends that way. You know, if we have disagreements, we usually compromise somewhere.
So even, you know, when I think about just looking around here at the paintings, any of these paintings, say the one behind you, you know, it looks like there's orange and gold and yellow, but none of those colors is just a single color.
Mm.
There are many colors that are combined together to create a color, and then it maybe morphs through to another color and become something else entirely. So even a color that you see in a painting is not just one color. It's many, many colors, right?
That's what Joe Campbell is talking about in that Myers interview. He calls it the net of Indra.
Mm.
It's the way all of these lines of life, I guess you could call them, or the colors of a painting, they cross each other. And at that point of crossing, there's a jewel. And in the jewel, there's everything else. And so it's a continuous overlapping of things. The joy of, we used to call it in Wisconsin, where they grew a lot of corn and things, hybrid vigor. So this is the kind of thing that many people are afraid of, because they're afraid of escaping the binarity of black-white, of Negro versus Caucasian, of Asian versus this. They're terrified of something, and I don't know what that is, because the conglomeration and the aggregation that we look forward to is going to be the solution to all of this mess that we have created on the basis of binarity. And it's important for us to remember that we use devices that are based upon yes, no. All of our computers are based upon on, off, and there's no noise in them. The son of an important physicist, Nobel Prize winner from Princeton, his name is George Dyson. His father was Freeman Dyson, a very intelligent and useful describer of theoretic physics. The son started out at Berkeley. He lasted 3 months and quit. And you were talking about living in a tree house. And George went up to Oregon or Washington and built himself a tree house on a huge, tall tree and lived in it for 3 years. George wrote a book called Analogia, which means analogy, of course. And one of the things that computers started out with, and the first computer I ever built, was an analog computer with little knobs that you twist, and you had a lot of noise in it. It wasn't completely yes, and it wasn't completely no. And so this, he's recommending, and I think with great reason, that we introduce more noise into our lives, into our computers, into our thinking, into almost everything we do.
The kind of noise that I would like to have in my life is more of that spark that you talked about when you were talking about neurology and that spike of neurons and how one thing sparks you off in a particular direction. And it's fueled by curiosity and questions and a desire to understand and to learn and to build things and create things. Let's take a short break, and you will hear an excerpt of Jack Leisring playing one of his original compositions on the piano. Stay tuned. In case you're just joining us, this is Aspire with Osha, Art, Nature, Humanity, and I'm your host, Osha Hayden, and I am here with Jack Leisring, Renaissance man and artist. How do you approach learning all these many things that you have accomplished?
I would say that I learned most things in life by making mistakes. Mm-hmm. By allowing that to come into your life and not being overwhelmed by the fact that you've screwed up again is, I think, very essential. For me, it is. I'm not a person to give advice to other people because they have to learn it themselves. For those who are listening to this and are searching for advice, I'd say do everything and make mistakes and make a lot of them because you'll learn from them.
Well, that's how science,
of course,
learns. That's how
it only works that way.
And how invention happens. Mm-hmm. You have to find a lot of ways not to do the thing right in order to find out how to do it right. And of course, in sculpture, when you created that big, how many feet tall the Minotaur?
It's about 10 feet
tall. 10 feet tall. Mm-hmm. You probably had to go through a few mistakes to get there in terms of your learning process. Mm.
Do you know the story of Thomas Edison and his...
Oh, yeah.
I guess he was his foreman. He came up to him and they were trying to figure out a filament for the light bulb. And foreman said, we've tried 1,500 things and nothing works. We've got to stop. We don't know anything. And he said, no, you know a great deal. You know 1,500 ways it doesn't work, which is very important, knowing what doesn't work.
Right, right.
We often don't remember that one.
And so now here, as we are sort of perched on the cliff of humanity, shall we say, at this juncture in time where we're dealing with truly an existential crisis, what I'm getting from some of the things you're saying is that if we use that spark, we use that spark to be curious about what we can do, what we can create, if we interface with a lot of people who will then spark us in different directions and maybe send us over here and over there, like you say, we become influenced and changed a little bit by those encounters. So if we allow ourselves to really go for it and find out how we can invent a way out of this crisis into a world that is more sustainable and that we want to live in and that will sustain life and allow life to thrive here on this planet, then those are some of the things we can try.
Well, think of George Gershwin, or maybe it was Ira who wrote the lines. It ain't necessarily so. The stories that you were told as a child, you know, Santa Claus, Tooth Fairy, you can go on from there. Without getting into any ism, I think the essential thing is to somehow learn to think for yourself and not accept that direct statement about something is a fact or is even important to you.
Question.
Yes, question everything, right? And never question everything and don't do anything. Or do everything.
Do everything.
Do everything, yes.
Yeah, because it is that spark that allows us to continue to be creative and curious and figure out what is the path through. What happens when we hit a dead end, you know?
Well, so, that's often the most valuable place, you know?
Yeah.
It's where we, you know, we say that to ourselves, and hopefully we do. And then we change and we do something else. That's the the joy of it. If you're doing something wrong, you can always change it. I just imagine what it must have been like for the first people to cross the Bering Strait and enter this thing that we now call America. They estimate that was 20,000, perhaps even longer, years ago. And what kind of courage did that take? To go off and
explore?
Not know what was going to happen at the end of that. It is, there's something in us that is so wonderful that we allow ourselves to do this. And what we're doing right now is another form of it.
It's an exploration, right?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Exploring ideas, exploring when a painter paints, they're exploring color and expression and ideas and form and all this wonderful mix and coming together of all of these influences in a single moment. And then you stand in front of it and you're, oh my God, I feel that in my body.
Well, again, I return to the fence idea. If we build fences around our knowledge that we think this is all there is to know, then we are trapped in, again, in our own kind of a maze. You know, it happens to be a square one, or maybe your fence is round. If there isn't a way out, I think you end up living your life based upon a set of rules. And I don't think that works for me.
Well, if you did live by a set of rules, you would go, okay, well, I already have a full-time job. There's no way that I can take on buying this mansion and completely refurbishing it, and especially after it's burned down, and recreate the whole thing. Or you would say, well, I'm just trying to get through school. There's no way that I can learn to play music well enough to be able to pay my way through school. Or you say, you know, we're standing on this cliff, there's no way off. But maybe there is. So I think, you know, you have to keep asking those questions, right? If we don't ask those questions, then we get stuck.
Well, I was also, you know, very fortunate to have a father who continuously said, you can do anything anybody else can do. Then he had a little fill-up at the end, but you have to do it.
So thank you so much for being with us today.
Well, thank you.
Mr. Jack Leisring. Let's tell our listeners how they can find out more about you, your website.
Well, I have five websites.
Okay.
But the one that is probably easiest and says the most would be JCLFA, and that means JC Leisring Fine Arts.com. So it's JCLFA.com, and that'll get you probably not much, but
there's a lot. There's so much there.
Have some fun. And again, it's if you find that it isn't very well written, it's because I wrote it. So.
Well, you're the author of 40 books. So,
but you know, I had to learn website stuff too. So that was fun for a while.
Well, and I just sitting here in this incredible space, and this is the J.C. Leisring Fine Arts Gallery right here.
I call it my studio.
Studio, mm-hmm. Okay. It is phenomenal. And the art that is here, I have really been into a gallery where so many pieces of art just really slay me.
Mm.
You know, they just...
Where you share something.
Yeah, yeah. And if you're lucky and you reach out to Jack Leisring, you might get an invitation if you have a group of people to come and do a tour.
Absolutely.
Anyway, thank you so much. What a pleasure it is.
Thank you, Osha.
And to my listeners, I hope that this interview has opened up some beautiful space in your mind for thinking about your life and what you can do, what is possible. And have an inspired week and live your joy. Until we meet again, thanks for listening.